for inviting me. I'd like to talk about work that I've done with Nimar Khani Hamed, Andy Cohen, and Ann Nelson, and it appears on the archive. Okay, so when dealing with the hierarchy problem, we usually assume that the physics which comes in to stabilize the weak scale against some UV scale, such as M. Gott or M. Planck, we always assume that this physics must manifest itself at a TV. So the next generation of colliders, we're going to see their superpartners or extra-dimensional KK modes, perhaps something exotic like strongly coupled gravity strings, or maybe even some kind of field theory like strongly coupled technicolor, or maybe even a CFT, something like Randall syndrome. And this is simply because in the standard model, we know that we have that we have gauge, Yukawa, and Higgs self-coupling interactions which contribute at one loop to quadratic divergence to the Higgs mass. So if we expect the Higgs mass to be something around 200 GeV, and these couplings are roughly of order 1, then it makes sense that the cutoff of the standard model should be at around 1 to 2 TeV, and therefore there's no fine-tuning involved in stabilizing the Higgs mass at 200 GeV. However, things are not so simple, because unfortunately, or fortunately, experiment agrees very well with the standard model. So there's a price to pay for adding new physics at a TeV. So in particular, just very broadly dividing the two types of approaches into a weakly and a strongly coupled approach at a TeV. For strongly coupled theories at a TeV, because there are strong couplings involved, as far as you can make any quantitative statements, which are difficult often, but you expect there to be large contributions to the electroweak parameters, STU. Many of these models suffer from flavor-changing neutral currents without adding some kind of additional structure. And because we have new physics at a TeV, you can potentially violate the standard model accidental symmetries like baryon lepton number symmetries, so forth, which also agree very well with experiment. The only weakly coupled candidate pretty much at a TeV that addresses the hierarchy problem is supersymmetry. So although it's weakly coupled and therefore does not really contribute much to ST and U, it still suffers from generically because it adds so many new particles and so many new parameters, for some generic value of parameters, it does suffer from flavor changing neutral currents, electrical dipole moments, ZP violation. It's highly non-minimal and has quite a few parameters that need to be explained why they are at the exact values such that it agrees so well with the standard model. And also it violates the standard model accidental symmetries, lepton number, and so forth. And we need to introduce other kinds of symmetries like parity, R-parity, to protect the experiment. And except for this, it also requires fine-tuning, because if you want to keep the soft parameters around the TeV and so push the superpartner masses to be of order a TeV, usually that requires a fine-tuning to actually get the Higgs to be significantly lower, that which is a factor of 100 in mass squared.
Why do you need to have M soft over 1 TeV, not about several hundred GeV?
Well, generically, I mean, if you want to deal with most flavor-changing neutral current kind of applications, or you do want to keep cis quarks, or there are always scalars that are there with.
You want to make them soft order of few TeV to avoid these MCMCs.
That's right. Usually, there's some other reason to keep M soft to be on the order.
Couple TeV is not enough.
That's right. So, okay, I mean, but the thing is that most of the superpartners you expect to be on the order of 1 TeV or so. And so that generically gives you soft masses which are of order 1 TeV. And so usually there's a kind of tension between pushing these guys up and naturally arguing also that at the same time the mass of the Higgs is at 200 GeV, which is factor of one. Basically, what it entails usually is tuning between the mu parameter and the soft M1, M2 masses. Okay. But it is generically a fine-tuning problem. So, like, wouldn't it be nice if there were basically two energy stages in the game? So the idea would be that at one TV, you have a certain type of physics, and this new physics that bothered you so much, before you push up at a decade above in energy. So that this is the idea of the little Higgs theory. So to be more precise, the idea is to realize the Higgs as part of a multiplet of pseudo-Goldstone bosons. And this goes back to old ideas of composite Higgs models. And at TV, the theory is just a weakly coupled nonlinear sigma model, which, as I will show you, can have a very minimal particle content, so it has small impact on the standard model observations. And then this nonlinear sigma model breaks down at around a 10 TV, where we some other UV completion, some new physics must come in. And this new physics can be any of our old friends. It could be SUSY, Technicolor, extra dimensions, whatever we like. But the point is that keeping this new physics at a higher scale makes it more plausible that you actually get agreement with the standard model. So what would be the minimal content of such a theory? Well, since we want to push off the cutoff to 10 TV, we'd better cancel the one-loop quadratic divergence in contributions to the Higgs mass. So very schematically, we know that the gauge sector, namely the W and B bosons, contribute to the Higgs mass. So wouldn't it be nice if there was just an additional? So in supersymmetry, we're used to opposite statistics particles canceling off quadratic divergences in the Higgs mass. And what we're going to try to do is use the same statistics particles. So for each particle which contributes in a quadratically divergent way to the Higgs mass, we're going to add a prime particle, an additional particle whose mass is going to be something on the order of TV that will cancel this quadratic divergence. So for the gauge sector, the electroweak gauge sector, we're going to add some W primes, which have basically the same quantum numbers as the W's, but are massive, and whose mass decreases with age. And so, one loop, these guys are going to cancel off the contributions of this one. We're going to add a scalar that will compensate for the Higgs self-coupling, and the divergence that comes from that. And as long as we're keeping the cutoff at 10 TV, we can ignore the first two generations of quarks just because they're Yukawa coupling is expected to be quite small. But we definitely cannot ignore the top, whose Yukawa coupling we expect to be of order 1. And therefore, the top must also have a kind of partner, a heavy top, that will come in and cancel the quadratic divergence that comes from the top of the standard model. No, I mean this looks kind of funny, but since you're gonna, this is actually just a pion. It's really embedded in the nonlinear sigma model, and so nonlinear sigma model is a perfectly unitary theory.
This bare mass, how do you get this bare mass as M for the W prime?
I'll show you in a moment. So. This is basically kind of a wish list, and I'll show you in detail how you generate all these particles. Okay, so this is essentially the minimal kind of content that we expect to get, and I'd like to show you a model in which exactly that's all you get and nothing else. So this is the smallest little Higgs model that you can arrange. Okay, so what the model looks like is the following. So as I said, at 10 to 20 TV, there's a cutoff because the nonlinear sigma model breaks down. Some new physics comes in whose character I don't know, but is largely irrelevant for the next generation of colliders, which are going to be mostly probing this energy. And at this energy, we find exactly W and B prime, additional massive gauge bosons with the same quantum numbers as the electroweak gauge bosons we're familiar with. We're going to find a scalar, which is a singlet under SU3, but a triplet under SU2 and has charge 1, and this additional T prime field. Below one TV, we find nothing except one Higgs doublet, namely the standard model Higgs doublet, and of course there's the rest of the standard model. And in this particular model, even though we've added all this new physics at around a TV, we'll find that the Higgs doublet is naturally smaller. I mean, it is exactly a factor of 10 smaller in mass. Without any kind of fine-tuning, this will happen automatically. It's weakly coupled at a TV, so we don't expect to have strong impact on the electroweak STU parameters, which makes it, for the first time, plausible that maybe you can even look for a technicolor-like completion at 10 to 20 TV. It's a very minimal model, has minimal content, and has something like 9 parameters. And just on its own, it really does not generate any new flavor-changing neutral current contributions because, as we'll see, because we're only interested in compensating for the top, we're only going to modify, add new flavor physics for the third generation and not for the first two, where the constraints are most strong. Also, because this is a weakly coupled theory, at 1 TeV, we expect the usual weakly coupled electroweak symmetry breaking. Namely, we are looking for our usual Higgs potential that has a negative mass squared and a quarter coupling roughly of order 1. And we'll see that all this comes automatically out of the interactions themselves. Namely, we'll see that the gauge sector will generate for us this order 1 quarter coupling, and the top sector will generate a negative mass squared for the Higgs, which will trigger electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay, so let's see. How do we build this model? So the principle is to try to eliminate quadratic quadratically divergent contributions to the Higgs mass at one loop, and in such a way that the only contribution that is quadratically divergent must come in at least a two-loop order. And if it comes in a two-loop order and the coupling is roughly of order 1, then we can assume that safely that the cutoff is around 10-20 TeV without a problem. And what we're going to use is our intuition from dimensional deconstruction models. So let me just remind you how this worked. If you look at this kind of moose or quiver diagram of where each of these nodes are a gauge group and each of the lines is a link in the bifundamental, then if you take the Wilson line, namely the product of all these links around, which is the dimensional deconstruction, if you like, of the A5 component of the gauge field, then we know that A5, since in the full continuum theory, the A5 can only get a quadratically divergent mass that goes as one of the radius squared. That's because locally gauge transformation is protected, but we know that globally at the scale of R this is broken, so we expect the mass like this. In the Moose diagram where there's N sites, this is the same fact as getting a contribution which is suppressed by N. And moreover, so this is as far as the this one? Well, so from some interaction, some matter. Right, it's not there a tree level, right? I mean, you're assuming that you're just writing the five-dimensional F mu nu squared. And so there's no mass at tree level, but interactions could possibly give rise to a mass at loop level, but since you know that at distances smaller than the compactification radius better look like just a five-dimensional theory, you know you have gauge transformations to protect it, so at worst, the mass has to go as 1 over R. And this is basically what you find in these deconstruction models, namely that at one loop, if you integrate out the gauge bosons, the Kaluza-Klein modes, basically, then you do find a contribution to the mass of this Wilson line, which goes as 1 over N squared.
Are you going to write down your model precisely for us?
Right? Yes. I'm just motivating the kind of techniques. But also, besides this finite contribution, there's a contribution which depends on the cutoff. But the thing is that you really have to turn on every single coupling in the chain to break the global symmetry which protects this guy. And therefore, the quadratic divergence can only come in at nth loop order. So you really have to involve all of these couplings. And that's the philosophy that we're going to use. Namely, we're going to consider this nonlinear sigma model, and where there's a global symmetry which protects the Higgs from getting a mass because it's a Goldstone boson. And then what we're going to do is we're going to add global symmetry breaking interactions to this nonlinear sigma model in such a way that no single interaction breaks the global symmetry protecting the Higgs by itself. And therefore, interactions have to combine, they have to act in together to break the Higgs global symmetry. And so there's no way that we're going to get a one loop quadratic divergence. There will have to involve at least two couplings. And in fact, that's what we're going to do. We're basically going to eat a two-site kind of Moose model and involve two couplings. All right, so let me show you in detail how the model works. So what we're going to do is going to consider the Higgs of Spartan SU5 mod SO5 coset space. It's, the Higgs is going to be part of a multiplet of Goldstone bosons, which parametrize this SU5 mod SO5. And using this intuition that we've gained from dimensional deconstruction, we're going to take two copies of the electroweak group instead of one. And as I'll show you, what we're going to arrange is that no single copy breaks the global symmetry associated with the Higgs, and they always have to act together to break the global symmetry associated with the Higgs, and therefore the Higgs cannot get a quadratic divergence at one loop. So the reason we've chosen SU5 mod SO5 is that in this arrangement we can embed the product of the two, and it gets broken down to our diagonal, which we identify as our electroweak group. And moreover, as we'll see, there's an SU3 which contains each one of these factors. So suppose I isolate this gauge sector, this particular copy is embedded in SU3, and this SU3 is exactly where the Higgs is going to live. And so we needed a group here that contains at least something like SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, and that's why we chose SU5, and we wanted the same symmetry breaking pattern that breaks it down to the diagonal, mimicking the kind of physics that we are used to from dimensional deconstruction models. Okay, so let's write down the model more precisely. So we're going to parametrize the nonlinear sigma model with this field sigma. Sigma is going to be is a symmetric tensor. It's going to be transforming in the following way under SU5. And it's going to be unitary. And since it's symmetric and unitary, it has 14 degrees of freedom, namely the 25 generators of SU5 minus the 10 generators of SO5. So the broken symmetries are parametrized by 14 degrees of freedom. And now let me describe what are the numbers, the quantum numbers under SU2 cross U1 of these 14 Goldstone bosons. So first you get a singlet and a triplet, which are neutral, and these guys are exactly the guys that get eaten when this product group breaks into the diagonal. Then there's a piece which is exactly the Higgs doublet, so it has exact quantum numbers of the Higgs, and we find an additional scalar, which is going to be our triplet phi, and we'll see that this guy actually gets a mass of order TeV. Okay. So we parameterize it in the usual way that we're used to from chiral Lagrangians. We have some kind of condensate, and this condensate sigma naught preserves the SU2 cross U1 group. And we parameterize the Goldstone bosons with some matrix pi in such a way that when you take some SU5 element and you act on this matrix pi, then it shifts the pi fields and rotates them and multiplies them times some matrix in SO5, but this matrix actually cancels. Oh, yeah, maybe I should be a little more explicit about that. It's not clear in the way I wrote it, but you can actually use identities to show that this is an equivalent form for the matrix sigma. And so since we assume that sigma naught H transpose is equal to sigma naught, And we see that this definition of sigma makes sense because when we act with an SU5 element from both sides, then H just goes right through and gets killed. Okay. Alright, so now let me describe in more detail how these guys actually sit inside of our pion matrix, our Goldstone-Boson matrix. So it turns out that in a convenient basis, the Higgs, so this is a 2x2 block, and this is a 5x5 matrix, and so the Higgs sits in this sort of column here, 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 and there, and the triplet scalar sits in these places, and I've ignored the additional Goldstone bosons, which actually sit over here because they're eaten, and so I'm just going to count them as degrees of freedom of the heavy gauge bosons. So this is how I'd like to embed the 2SU2 cross U1 copies. The first copy is going to sit in the top column, in the top square, sorry, and the hypercharge is given by a diagonal, lives here, and the second copy is going to live down here, and its diagonals, the Y2 is given by a diagonal matrix like so. And so what you notice is exactly this SU3 that I was talking about, namely that this guy, Q1, leaves this SU3 invariant as a global symmetry, which acts on this part. But you see that this SU3, some of its generators are going to act non-linearly on the Higgs. Okay? And similarly, for this other copy of SU2, it lives in this bottom piece. And so it leaves this SU3, the top SU3, as a global symmetry. And again, some of the generators of that SU3 can be seen to act non-linearly on the Higgs. So basically, each one of these gauge groups leaves a global symmetry that acts non-linearly on the Higgs. And therefore, the Higgs cannot gain a mass from interactions with a single one of these gauge groups. But together, these gauge groups break all the global symmetry that protects the Higgs, and therefore they can give the Higgs a mass. We expect the Higgs mass at two loops. Okay, so let me write down the Lagrangian then. It's the usual Kyle-Lagrangian type of interaction. So we have a kinetic term for sigma, and that kinetic term is just the usual kinetic term with the gauge interactions included. So we've got for each one of the copies W and the B type of interactions. However, that's not the whole story, because we know that when we write down a nonlinear sigma model, we have to write down all terms that are consistent with the symmetry. And we do know that once we introduce gauge interactions, there'll be quadratically divergent contributions at one loop. And so consistent with the gauge and global symmetries is another type of term that we have to write down, namely a potential term. This potential term looks like the following. It's got Q sigma star, and similarly for the hypercharge copies. And so now the question is, what is the... These are the exact kind of terms that you expect in a Kyle-Lagrangian. These are the terms that, for example, due to electromagnetism, shift the mass of the pi plus and pi minus from the pi zero. So this is, we're used to having terms like this. And now the question is, what is the natural size for this coefficient C? Well, what we're going to use is naive dimensional analysis, namely that we are going to just assume that the term that appears in the Lagrangian is of the same size as the natural counter term that we would have to write down when we normalize this theory. And as I said before, at one loop, we expect there to be a quadratically divergent contribution, but our cutoff lambda is of order 4 pi f, right? That's where our theory breaks down, the nonlinear sigma model breaks down, and so naturally, this contribution is of order g squared f squared, and so this coefficient here is naturally of order 1. Moreover, in analogy with the Kyle-Lagrangian, we're going to assume that this coefficient is positive. So now, let's expand this potential and see what we get. Well, we can sort of guess just from the global symmetry. And that's because, as I mentioned before, each of these SU3s has some kind of transformation. One of its generators, which just shifts the Higgs. And while it acts non-linearly on the Higgs, it acts linearly on the triplet phi. In this way, with a minus sign for one of these SU3s that respects one of the gauge groups, and the other SU3, which is left invariant by the second gauge group, has a different plus sign here. So the only, plus higher order terms, of course, since it's a nonlinear sigma model. So to lowest order, the only terms that we could possibly get, which are invariant under the symmetries, is for the one of the copies, we would get a term like this, and from the other copy, you would get a term like that. So notice, by the way, that if we forget about the Higgs, the assumption that the coefficient C is positive is just the assumption that phi gets a positive mass. And that's exactly what we expect in the Kyle-Lagrangian. Pi plus pi minus is indeed more massive than pi zero. And if the mass was negative, then, of course, we would discover that we're in the wrong vacuum, and you would break SU2 cross U1. So this is a kind of a self-consistent assumption that we're, in fact, in the right vacuum, the SU2 cross U1 preserving vacuum. And so there's, by analogy to the Kyle-Lagrangian, we don't have a vacuum alignment problem. So indeed, we see that phi, which didn't really, there was no symmetry protecting its mass, and therefore it gets a mass of order GF, so roughly a TeV. The Higgs, on the other hand, does not have a mass. And so below GF, we can just integrate phi out. And integrating it out, we actually find that there's a quarter coupling that is generated, an effective quarter coupling that's generated for the Higgs. And that quarter coupling we expect to be of order 1 just because this coefficient C we argued was of order 1, and we expect each of these gauge couplings also to be of order 1. And notice how this worked. If we decided to cancel this line, so we ignored one of these gauge interactions and we integrated out phi, this whole thing would just vanish and we'd find no potential for the Higgs. Similarly, if we canceled this guy off and integrated out phi, we'd find no potential for the Higgs, since it is the true Goldstone boson. But together, these guys break the global symmetry associated with the Higgs. So integrating out phi actually gives a quarter coupling to the Higgs of order 1. And now, by the way, I did mention that G and G prime are just combinations of the old. They're basically the diagonal coupling that you get, namely the electroweak coupling. So, in addition to this, so we've looked at the quadratic. So we've argued that we look basically at the quadratically divergent contributions, if you like, to the Higgs potential, because they come from the UV theory itself. But there's also IR contributions from actually integrating out the massive states themselves. So we saw that we have a massive scalar phi, and also because of the Higgsing, we get massive gauge bosons, W prime and B prime. Plugging this into the Coleman-Weinberg potential, we get an actual contribution, which is comes in at one loop, and it's only logarithmically sensitive to the cutoff. So we can't predict its exact value, but we know that it's not quadratically divergent, and that's the important part. And since all these guys, all their masses are roughly of order F, and because it's a one-loop contribution, there's something like a 1 over 4 pi squared here, everything is roughly of order 1, we naturally get a positive contribution, which is something of the order of 200 GeV, assuming that F is around 1 TeV. And so this is exactly the analog of what we'd get from the So these contributions are exactly the analog of this contribution to the Wilson line, or this contribution to the five-dimensional component. So they're the finite contributions, and they go basically as the mass of the heavy KK particles. Okay, so we saw how we could get the quartic coupling. Now let's see how we could generate the negative mass squared. So, as I argued before, we can ignore the first two generations simply because their Yukawa couplings are quite small, and so even if there is a quadratically divergent contribution, we don't expect that contribution to be very large. But that's not the case for the top, where we expect the quartic coupling to be of order 1, so we better do something about its contribution to the divergence. And what we're going to do is so what we need to do is make sure that one of the global symmetries that protects the Higgs is actually there in the Yukawa interactions. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the top and bottom, the left-handed fields, and add an additional top, which I'm going to call T tilde, making it a triplet of SU3, one of these SU3s that protects the Higgs. And then what we're going to do is we're going to write down this epsilon tensor contracted chunk. So we're going to take, if you recall, our Higgs matrix, we're basically going to take this piece of it. And that's the IJ goes from 1 to 3 and XY goes from 4 to 5 chunk of it, so it contains the Higgs. And using these epsilons, we're going to make sure that this thing is actually invariant under SU3.
I'm sorry, in your full coset theory,
yes.
What representation are these blocks in?
So, so I've broken SU5. In this case,
just write down the whole theory. So, what representation are they?
Oh, they're just so. Well, they're not in a good representation in a sense because I've explicitly broken SU5 by them, right? Because they're only in, say, this SU3 of the SU5 matrix. So they're kind of a triplet under this SU3.
But before you break it, what representation are they?
I've assumed that I have some explicit breaking in the theory. If you like, there's perhaps they were in a 5, and I've integrated these two guys out at the cutoff scale.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. You introduce a 5. Let me introduce a 5. Okay?
Oh, these are...
introduce a 5.
Okay.
So that's a representation as your 5.
Right.
They're chiral fields. Masters before you have it as a weak breaking.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, these are different fields. These are not the the fields that condense to make the matrix sigma. Right, so there'll be...
I'm just worried about where the top quark or electron is. Okay. Where the electrons, light quarks, what representation are they in your full theory?
Okay, so they are under... They're charged under the...
How do you can draw a table of your spectrum?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sure. It's a bit hard to
follow. Sure. Right, so, well, I mean, so we have an SU2 cross U1, one copy, and an SU2 cross U1, second copy. Okay? These guys are living inside of the SU5, but this is the only gauge piece.
Yes.
Okay? So, so the SU2 cross U1, one of them lives here and the other one lives here. So there's one and there's two in the matrix, right? And this looks something like this. Right, the Higgses live here. And this triplet would transform only under SU2 cross U1. So it might... It's not necessarily invariant under the full global SU5.
Okay.
Right.
So this triplet would transform...
Right, so this triplet is transforming only, let's say, under this copy, under this SU2 cross U1. So it's in the, it's a fundamental under this SU3. So there's this top, bottom, and T tilde.
Okay, so where's the right-handed?
Yeah, so the right-handed thing, right. So there's a right-handed guy, which I just called T prime, and then I'm adding T tilde and a right-handed.
Yeah. What representation are they in? So.
Oh.
I just want to know the assignment of the
copy. Oh, sorry. So yeah. So the right-handed, that's right. So this guy is charged under one of these copies, and the right-handed one, T prime, is charged only under U1.
Both U1 or?
Yeah, both U1s, yes.
And that same with the leptons and other?
That's right. So, I mean, with the leptons, though, I don't have to do something so fancy. I don't have to include, for example, this T tilde. I can write just the same couplings down without this T tilde because I don't care about preserving any global symmetry since I don't worry about the quadratic divergence. So in yes, just this SU3, right? Because this SU3 is already acting nonlinearly on the Higgs.
Normally, I think your starting point is a kind of right down with nonlinear scale model for SU5 or SO5.
Right.
Okay, normally, all the meta-based constraints strip the representation of SO5 on
row
SO5
of the signal. Well, I mean,
you call the break
that SO5 to SU3. Okay, so first of all, let me mention that this is just for simplicity. I can actually do the same kind of technique by preserving the full SU5. I just have to add more matter. So what you can do is
SO5 for the meta sector, for the coordinate sectors. Mm-hmm. You need to bring non-linear realization as U5, but for the meta
parameters, theoretically,
meta parameters, it's just a linear
realization of S05. That's right. But it's a global symmetry, so in particular, I can imagine that I have some kind of additional interactions in my UV theory, which actually breaks this global symmetry, which I've not... That, well, yeah.
So then, then how can I? What is how can you justify that the sigma model is a good approximation?
Because it's not badly broken. Right, it's not really badly broken. And the reason is because I'm assuming that the coefficient here, lambda 1 and lambda 2, are of order 1. So they're not 4 pi.
S05 break.
Right.
Talking of S05 break.
Right. But I'm assuming that I've added some small interactions to my SU5 symmetric model, just like I've added these gauge boson interactions, which also break SU5, right? And they generate for me a potential for all these Goldstone bosons, which breaks.
If your break is a kind of small breaking,
yes,
you're tuning.
then you should, I mean, comparatively, you should make the whole your parameters as S05 multiply, because S05 is just broken by small amount. Did you say?
Yeah, that's really
well. Okay, I mean,
right. The thing is that you got a choice: it's badly broken or slightly broken.
Right.
If it's slightly broken, then things should come in representations of your symmetry
S05,
and then you break a little bit. If it's badly broken, I don't argue, but then the symmetry don't even exist in principle.
Well, I mean, I could...
So you cannot have smallly broken, you cannot break the symmetry lightly, and your representation is not completed in the symmetry which you will break only slightly. I mean, that doesn't seem to be a consistent approach.
But you have... What you've done is you're assuming that you've gotten some sort of additional matter that maybe completes this SU3, multiply it into SU5, but you've just integrated it out.
Well, I don't know how you integrate out because they start out massless, right? They're chiral fields.
No. These guys are not. I mean, these are not the...
But then cannot form a multiplet because the bottom form are left-handed only.
So right. No, but...
Cannot form a multiplet.
Yeah, but
which is not chiral.
Oh, of course, yes. So I'm assuming that. Okay, so let me I should describe for you a scenario which is completely clean.
Yes.
Okay, so this is a scenario which is completely clean. You just take this sigma, Okay, and you shield it with complete SU5 multiplets on both sides. So besides this top, bottom, and so on, you have to fill out the full SU5, and you do the same thing on this side. And then what you do is then you just add masses to the guys that you don't want. So this you would agree is small breaking, because I'm adding a mass which is small in the sense that it's not 4 pi f, but it's only f. I'm assuming I have some kind of small spurion, small coupling in the game, such that this mass is only of order f rather than of order 4 pi f, which is what you would expect for a large coupling. So there's a...
The multiplet now at this moment, at least at this stage, are Cairo fermions.
Right, so I'm going to add some additional fields. So there'll be some field Q in here, and I'm going to add Q tilde, and I'm going to want to get rid of some other field here, and I don't know, call it big T, and I'm going to add some other mass to it, T tilde. So these are just soft contributions, which are small, because I'm assuming implicitly that I have some kind of small parameter in the game that breaks the global symmetry weakly.
That's very good. So let me be specific. You have T, B, T, some...
Right.
Right, okay.
Right, and some kind of triplet here.
Right.
And here, one of these guys is going to play the role of my... So basically, okay, so let me be specific here. Yeah.
I don't want to delay your talk, but...
Sure. Well, it's okay. I don't have that much more to say anyway. So the idea is the following. So suppose I just call this Q left, and then I have some additional, I don't know, chi 3 multiplet here. Which is also left-handed. And I have some top, which is going to be my eventual top, and some additional fields here. And some other chi prime. And so the point is that... if I add a mass that looks something like Q left Q tilde, adding additional Q tildes, and then T tilde, where this is right-handed and these guys are all also right-handed, then there'll be some combination of this which is actually massless after I look.
Can you put the label correctly? You have Q left and...
Yeah, this is right. These are all right.
Some other fields.
Yeah, some other fields. So this is my spurion that breaks the global symmetry, just a little bit.
Okay, so the top won't get a mass now, or what?
No, it does not, actually. It's the opposite way, because what happens is that there'll be some... So out of here, you'd get some kind of term that looks like MQ left... Well, F. So assume... Let me put some dimensions here. So this is all of order F, right? These are all masses of order F. And what you're going to find is that Q left marries some Q here, and then... But then there'll be some massless combination. So because you'll get Q left, and then you'll also get, like, Q left... You're right, tilde. So one combination is going to be massless.
So naturally, your model will predict some fermion at a TV scale.
That's right. Exactly. So now,
unavoidable, right?
Yeah, it's unavoidable. So the point is that this is assuming some kind of spurion structure which actually keeps. Minimal content at a TV scale. Otherwise, yeah, you know, usually I will have more fermions at a TV scale which fill up these multiplets.
And you don't consider this fine-tuning?
No, because this is the same kind of interaction as the gauge interaction. I'm just assuming roughly, if you like, that I have some small coupling here. So that, you know, naively you would have said, what's the mass of some sort of fermion, right? It's going to be my cutoff, right? So which is going to be 4 pi f. But I'm assuming that whatever... spurion broke this global symmetry small so that it's 1 over 10. So it's naturally, that's all I have to assume. So it's not, I wouldn't even call it fine-tuning because it's 1 over 10. I mean, this idea was just from the point of view of a minimal content. And of course, I have to assume more structure to get something like this. If you want to keep it as clean as possible, what I have to assume is some kind of additional fields which have some transformation properties under SU5, and these fields somehow condense and get expectation values that break this SU5 for me. So they generate these epsilons for me. So, yeah, it's a bit more involved. I mean, there's a simple generalization of this that's cleaner, but I think this is just nice because I think it's most minimal, and you can't imagine a sector that does that. Okay, so let me just explain just finally how this works. All right, so the idea is that this preserves that SU3 one, But then I'm going to take this guy, and I'm going to couple it to some other quark, and which is a right-handed quark, and this guy's going to be an SU3 singlet. So this term explicitly breaks this SU3. So the point is, though, that, of course, this term does not know anything about the other SU3, so on its own it cannot break the global symmetry of the Higgs. Again, this by itself cannot break the global symmetry of the Higgs because it preserves this SU3, but together they can. That's the same philosophy. And so what we get if we look at the contribution is we exactly get this sort of term that I wrote before. We get a mass matrix, which is a kind of seesaw mass matrix for the fermions, a mixing between T, which is grows up as the Higgs, so this is exactly our top quark, and as an additional massive quark whose mass actually decreases with the Higgs. And so exactly what you get is that when you integrate out the heavy field, you get exactly a negative contribution. Negative, well, both because it's a fermion and also because there's a negative sign here, so all the negatives actually match up, and give you a negative contribution to the Higgs mass, also sensitive logarithmically to the cutoff. And so, in a sense, this works exactly the same way as you would expect in supersymmetry, in the sense that in supersymmetry, you have the quark, the top quark, whose mass goes up with Higgs, with the Higgs, and you have the squark, which compensates for that, whose mass goes down with Higgs, and together they cancel and give a negative net negative contribution, which drives electric symmetry breaking radiatively. Exact same thing here, except that it's the same statistics particle. And so if we plug in this guy and we get a negative contribution, and since this Yukawa coupling to the top we expect to be of order 1, while the KH couplings are quite small, it's conceivable that this contribution will dominate and we'll get a negative contribution to the mass of the Higgs. And so we've got the entire Higgs potential, the quartic coupling, the negative contribution, and so electroweak symmetry breaking happens dynamically. Okay, so let me conclude already. A little early. So I hope I convinced you that there's a new class of viable models in which electroweak symmetry breaking happens dynamically. It's weakly coupled at a TEV, which is where we're going to probe our next generation of colliders. So this is the most relevant physics. The little Higgs, called little, which I've never explained why, but because it is actually lighter than everybody else, naturally. And it has the right potential, comes right out of the same interactions that we've used to protect its mass at one loop. Models are very minimal. There's just very few content, no strong coupling, so we expect small impact on physics. But of course, this needs to be investigated, and there's plenty of things to do for the future. I didn't explain this, but there could be bounds on that come from electroweak parameters, and that's mostly because of interaction with the additional scalar. If you recall, there was some interaction that looked like this, plus another interaction that looked like that. Well, this means that inside of here, there's a cubic coupling. And so when the Higgs gets a VEV, this can actually generate a VEV for a potential for the phi field. So this could have an effect on the rho parameter, but the contribution we expect to be small simply because it's proportional to the difference of the two couplings. And so the actual contribution will go something like the difference of the two couplings times mw squared over f squared, which is TV, so that's quite small. But in any case, this needs to be investigated. And one of the advantages, I guess I should already mention since I wrote this guy down on the board, is that I didn't talk about it, but the top sector, this guy, does generate a quadratically divergent contribution, just the same as the gauge sector, namely a product of four sigmas. So it does actually contribute to the quarter coupling. And so one way to try to eliminate this difference is to impose some discrete symmetry that says that G1 is equal to G2, but then you're faced with the problem that you've still got this quartic sector, the top sector generating for your quartic coupling, which might induce an interaction, a cubic interaction like this, and that's the advantage of this. In this approach, all the symmetry breaking is soft, and therefore there's never a quadratically divergent piece, and if you do impose a symmetry that exchanges G1 and G2, which is very natural because their interactions are identical, then in fact you don't even find this contribution to the electroweak parameter, so it's even better. But in any case, the presence of these additional gauge bosons, which look just the same as W bosons, affects things like the muon lifetime and so on. So there's a lot of physics that can be investigated. One thing that's obviously missing from this whole approach is unification. So one might hope that there's some way of getting this SU3 unification a la Dimopoulos Kaplan, in which they've added an additional SU3 gauge factor and argue that 0.23, which is the weak angle, is very close to 0.25, which is the natural value you'd get out of SU3, and there are ways of doing that. So people are already working on this. And of course, very important is to see how easy is it to put some realistic UV completion to this model, whether it be supersymmetry or a technicolor-like completion or maybe a combination of both some kind of strong dynamics and supersymmetry. Yes, and of course, a lot more other things. In fact, it's almost a funny joke, right? Because this SU5 mod SO5 coset space is the exact coset space that people consider in the composite Higgs models. And from that point of view, all we've done is put two copies of SU2 cross U1 in there. And therefore, the problem with composite Higgs models is that there was always an enormous fine-tuning involved, because the whole thing is you couldn't get this quartic coupling of order 1 and at the same time get a small mass square. But, you know, so, yeah, I was talking to Georgia, and basically he said, how come I didn't think of this 20 years ago? So it's, it took us extra dimensions in the construction to realize that all you have to do is put two copies of SU2 cross U1 in the game. Yeah, but it's fair to say that, well then, and once we were conscious of the global symmetry structure, you also had to take care of the top sector, but pretty much that's just the idea of the...
Any more questions? No.